10 to 15. For Thursday, partly sunny, highs near 34. Thanks for listening to KAXE.
I'm very proud to have done what I did on January 6th, and I think that it was just the beginning of what America needs to cleanse itself.
Trump supporters who attacked the Capitol 5 years ago gathered again today in Washington. The mood was different.
Today is Tuesday, January 6th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead this hour, the story of efforts to actively rewrite the history of January 6th, 2021.
Also, how America's allies are navigating America's interest in Greenland.
Europe depends so much on the U.S. for its own defense and for the future of Ukraine. And the Trump administration is well aware of this.
Plus, after the L.A. wildfires, California is on the brink of adopting the toughest rules in the country about flammable vegetation.
I'm seeing my St. Augustine grass burning. There's hundreds of little tiny fires burning in the yards and next to the houses of all my neighbors.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. The Trump administration is marking the fifth anniversary of the January 6th riot with a web page that insists rioters were peaceful that day. The page states that Democrats, quote, staged the real insurrection by certifying a fraud-ridden election. And it says that a Capitol Police officer murdered rioter Ashley Babbitt in cold blood. She was fatally shot while climbing through a smashed window at the Capitol. Courts and elections officials nationwide have repeatedly affirmed that Joe Biden won the election in 2020. Venezuela is still in shock after the U.S. apprehended President Nicolas Maduro. NPR's Eder Peralta says many Venezuelans are still waiting to see how their government will change.
Maduro was taken by the United States, and he's, you know, in court now in the United States facing charges. But Delcy Rodriguez takes over, who was his vice president. And what, you know, some people I spoke to said is she's exactly the same as him. Mm-hmm. And unless the whole government is taken out, then things will change in Venezuela.
NPR's Eder Peralta reporting. Leaders from Europe, the U.S., Canada, and NATO have agreed on international defense guarantees for Ukraine. More than two dozen of Ukraine's allies met today in Paris to work out details of a proposal to end Russia's nearly four-year-old war there. But as NPR's Lauren Freyer reports, Russia still needs to agree to them.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says the U.S. would monitor and verify a ceasefire, then Britain and France would send peacekeepers.
The U.K. and France will establish military hubs across Ukraine and build protected facilities.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky calls the plan for equipment, training and air, land and sea support a huge step forward. President Trump's advisor and son-in-law Jared Kushner calls it a milestone. Starmer said they made excellent progress, but cautioned that the hardest yards are still ahead and said Russian President Vladimir Putin is, quote, not showing that he is ready for peace. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 1% today, notching its latest record high. As NPR's Raphael Nam reports, investors are ignoring geopolitics to focus on the economy.
Venezuela may be all over the headlines, but it's really not the main story for Wall Street investors. The S&P is also in record high territory, gaining about 0.6%. A big reason is optimism about the economy and corporate profits. Although there are certainly signs of weakness across the economy, in manufacturing, for example, there are enough positive developments. Take wealthier consumers who continue to spend money. But investors are bracing for the latest jobs data coming out on Friday, given that the labor market is showing signs of cooling. Rafael Nam, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. A Texas teachers union is suing the state's education department and accusing it of improperly investigating teachers' social media comments following the killing of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. The lawsuit argues that the Texas Education Agency violated the free speech rights of school employees. Swiss officials say a ski resort bar that caught fire New Year's Eve, killing more than 40 people, had not been inspected in 5 years. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley has more.
Nous le regrettons amèrement. Nicolas Ferraud, mayor of Crans-Montana, said he bitterly regretted the failure to carry out annual inspections and said the investigation would tell how much of a role that played in the disaster. We will assume all of our responsibility, he said. At least 40 people died in the blaze. More than 100 were injured. The victims were between the ages of 14 and 39. At least 20 were minors. The drinking age in Switzerland is 16. The soundproofing foam on the basement ceiling that caught fire from sparklers was installed in a do-it-yourself job by the owners. They're now under investigation for homicide by negligence. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Deaths of on-duty law enforcement officers in the U.S. decreased by nearly 25% in 2025, according to an annual report. The National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund says the drop to 111 deaths last year includes decreases in officers killed by firearms and in traffic-related incidents. Officials say training, medical resources, and public awareness account for some of the decrease, but it also comes down to luck. I'm Ryland Barton. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, celebrating 100 years of giving for good. More at mott.org/100. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It is 5:06. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, hosting their weekly pasta bar Wednesdays from 5 to 8 with an assortment of proteins, vegetables, and sauces to choose from. Information about their dinner menu at timberlakelodgehotel.com. Patchy fog expected tonight with mostly cloudy skies, lows 14 to 18. More news is next on KAXE.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Here in Washington today, Trump supporters who attacked the Capitol on January 6th, 2021, took a victory lap.
I'm very proud to have done what I did on January 6th, and I think that it was just the beginning of what America needs to cleanse itself.
Jake Lang was charged with assaulting police during the riot. Even though Trump is president now, he said,
that does not mean the deep state and the globalists are not hot on our trail, and it'll come to the point where a real crusade is needed, and that's what we're gearing up for.
Jake Lang's case was dismissed as part of President Trump's order to pardon nearly all the January 6th defendants on his first day in office. Today's event looked nothing like what took place on this day just 5 years ago. We're going to revisit now a few key moments from January 6th, 2021, and a warning, this story includes descriptions of violence.
On January 6th, as police were desperately trying to hold back an armed and violent mob, some officers could barely keep their eyes open from the rioters' chemical sprays.
At a key entrance, one officer yelled, "If they breach those doors, it's all over."
He's got a weapon in his hand.
Okay.
Shields up front. Hold the line. Hold the line. Do not hold the line.
NPR investigative correspondent Tom Dreisbach has reported on January 6th from the very beginning, and he has a story today about how the government is actively trying to rewrite the history of that day.
That area where police tried to hold the line is called the Lower West Terrace Tunnel. It's narrow, dark. And on January 6th, Michael Fanone was at the head of a scrum of cops trying to keep the mob out.
And I remember trying to, like, appeal to them. And say, I said, like, we have injured officers here.
Stop, buddy. We got injured officers.
We have injured people.
Back it up.
And, like, it just seemed to set these guys off, and immediately after that, it's like all hell broke loose, and we start into the melee.
Come on, the PD, dig in! Let's go, push them back! Dig in!
Fanone and the cops behind him started to get some momentum, pushing back the rioters, but the momentum pushed Fanone too, and then a rioter put his arm around Fanone's neck and yelled.
I got one!
He says, I got one. I got one. And that's when I was just like, you know, when I'm out in this crowd, like, I'm being assaulted from every direction. So I'm trying to, like, keep people away from my weapon. People are yelling, like, kill him with his gun.
One man took an electroshock weapon and drove it into Fanon's neck twice. A handful of people tried to stop the assaults.
And that's when, like, my recollection goes from so vivid to, like, nothing.
Fanon collapsed face first. His partner, Jimmy Albright, helped drag him behind the police line.
We don't got it! We need your keys now!
I got it! My partner! Come on. Mike, stay in there, buddy. Mike, it's Jimmy. I'm here. Mike, I'm here for you, buddy. Come on, dude.
Fanon, wake up, brother.
Come on, Mike. Come on, buddy. We're going duck hunting soon.
Suddenly, his eyes opened.
Did we take that door back?
Yeah, we did.
Did we take that door back, he asked. And they did, but only after the vice president and members of Congress were forced to flee for their lives and after 140 police officers were injured. Fanon was one of them. He suffered a mild heart attack and a traumatic brain injury that still affects his memory. Another officer was assaulted with pepper spray and died of a stroke the next day. Two other officers took their own lives in the days afterwards. And after all that violence and destruction, at first, there was a kind of consensus about that day. Here's what Republican Senator Ted Cruz said 1 year later.
We are approaching a solemn anniversary this week, and it is an anniversary of a violent terrorist attack on the Capitol.
But that consensus fell apart.
You called this a terror attack when by no definition was it a terror attack. That's a lie.
Tucker Carlson confronted Cruz on Fox News.
The way I phrased things yesterday, it was sloppy and it was frankly dumb. And
I don't buy that.
Cruz said he only meant to call the people who assaulted police terrorists. But even that became up for debate. That same year, the Republican National Committee described January 6th as, quote, legitimate political discourse. Pro-Trump influencers spread conspiracy theories that the attack was an inside job by the deep state. And by 2023, Trump was posting that the cops should be charged and the protesters should be freed.
Ladies and gentlemen, Justice for All, featuring President Donald J. Trump and the J6 Choir.
Trump opened the very first rally of his 2024 election campaign with a version of the national anthem sung by January 6th defendants in jail, including people who assaulted cops. The Justice Department charged more than 1,500 people for their roles in the riot. More than 1,000 pleaded guilty. But that did not make Trump run from January 6th. He ran on it.
I call them the J6 hostages.
Many of those people are very innocent people. They did nothing wrong.
And they're great people. Many of them are just great people.
And on his first day back in office.
So this is January 6th. And these are the hostages. Approximately 1,500 for a pardon.
Yes.
Full pardon.
He issued mass pardons and began using the government to try to rewrite history. The administration fired prosecutors who worked on January 6th cases and hired a former January 6th defendant who urged rioters to kill cops. They deleted government information on January 6th, and NPR and other media organizations had to go to court to make sure video evidence would not be disappeared. Trump even issued a blanket pardon to anyone who tried to help him overturn the 2020 election. We are now a year into this effort to sanitize January 6th. Still, for many people who were there that day, it does not feel like a day of love so much as a day of loss, even for pardoned rioters.
I've been couch hopping effectively since I got out of prison. And, you know, I've been selling the few items that I still have, shoes, clothes. But it's really just, you know, praying and staying positive that eventually I'll find an opportunity that'll work.
Dominic Box was convicted of nonviolent charges for recording himself storming the Capitol. Now, he's hoping Trump will provide restitution to former defendants like him.
You know, despite everything that I have experienced, lost, given up, I wouldn't change anything about it.
Really?
Absolutely.
Even with everything, with the job loss, do everything the same.
Everything. The only thing I would probably do different is maybe bring another GoPro and get some more footage. But ultimately, you know, I still believe, and I would say I know that the election in 2020 wasn't clean. I believe that I was there doing what every American should have done.
Jason Riddle used to think like Box. He pleaded guilty to storming the Capitol and chugging a bottle of wine inside. He's an alcoholic, but since he's stopped drinking, he's rethought his support for Trump. And he's one of the very few rioters to reject the pardon.
I can't accept, you know, this is, cops have died. Trump is promoting criminal behavior. That was a criminal act. January 6th was a crime. So, and I think it's going to result in more death eventually. There's going to be another riot. Something's going to happen if you keep promoting these lies. That's what January 6th was. It was a result of his lies.
Since the pardon, some other rioters have gotten into more legal trouble for allegedly molesting children, breaking and entering, and threatening to kill House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. I asked the Trump White House about those cases. They said we were spreading left-wing talking points and that Trump gave pardons to people who were, quote, abused by the Biden justice system and aggressively over-prosecuted for political purposes. Then there's Michael Fanone. He resigned from the D.C. Police Department after January 6th. I sat down with him and we watched his body cam from the riot together, including the moments when he was nearly killed.
How does it feel to watch that?
It makes me miss the job.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I mean, I love being a cop. Yeah, you watch this now, and it's like, it's the last time I got to be a cop. Like, that's literally the last day of my career.
I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear you say, this is almost nostalgic in a way for you, given how it was probably the worst day of your career in policing.
I mean, like, was January 6th traumatic? Yes. Was it more traumatic than other experiences in my career? I don't know. I mean, what was traumatic was everything that happened afterwards. You know, I've got a president that pardoned all the people that assaulted me, called them patriots. I get death threats every single day. I lost my career. I lost my friends. I had my entire life turned upside down, all because of me doing my job.
Fanone told me he still talks about January 6th, but not because he expects it will change anyone's mind. Instead, now it's for the future, for history. Tom Dreisbach, NPR News.
And you can see all NPR's reporting on January 6th at npr.org/J6Archive. This is NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. There is more news ahead, and the Up North Report, local news from our region, airs at 5:30. Support comes from Clacko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 8 years now. Their tap room is open Monday through Thursday, 3 to 8, Friday and Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday, noon to 6. More info at clackobrewing.com. Taking a look at our weather for tonight, patchy fog, mostly cloudy, lows 14 to 18, northwest winds up to 15 miles per hour, patchy fog early tomorrow morning, then partly sunny, highs near 36, west winds 10 to 15, our lows tomorrow night down into the low 20s, and for Thursday, partly sunny, highs near 34. Support for KAXE comes from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement. Dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. We also thank Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. The American Red Cross is in need of blood and platelet donations to keep supplies steady. Find a blood drive near you at redcrossblood.org. North Central Small Business Development Center invites current and aspiring small business owners to the Entrepreneurs on Tap Learning Series beginning Wednesday, January 14th at Last Turn Brew Pub in Brainerd at 5 p.m. There's a different topic each month now through May. Find a full schedule at northcentralsbdc.com. More news is next on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State, since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Members of what's known as the Coalition of the Willing gathered in Paris today. That is the group of 35 countries committed to guaranteeing Ukraine's sovereignty if and when a peace agreement with Russia is reached. But the meeting was overshadowed by new worries about the U.S. administration's interest in a completely different place, Greenland. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley was following.
Pour la mise en place d'une force multinationale dans les airs, les
French President Emmanuel Macron said the coalition had nearly finalized details for a multinational force on air, land, and sea to bring a kind of reassurance to Ukraine once the war stops. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer expressed doubts.
We have to be frank. For all Russia's words, Putin is not showing that he's ready for peace. Over the last few weeks, we've seen the opposite.
But before the nations could even get down to working on Ukraine, they had to address another pressing issue of sovereignty that's resurfaced in the last days. The Trump administration wants Greenland, going by the recent comments of the president and his deputy chief of staff, Stephen Miller. So France, Germany, Italy, Poland, Spain, Britain, and Denmark issued a statement stressing that Greenland belongs to its people and that only Denmark and Greenland can decide the island's future. The statement spoke of collective action to protect the Arctic in conjunction with NATO and the U.S. The Europeans have to make nice, says Martin Quincey, head of the German Marshall Fund in Paris.
The Europeans are not able to take any kind of strong position on any issues related to U.S. foreign policy because Europe depends so much on the U.S. for its own defense and for the future of Ukraine.
Political scientist Dominique Moisy with the Institut Montaigne says this is an ironic moment.
With Europe facing two threats and not one. One from Russia, the classical one, and now one from the United States of America.
The U.S. did have a voice at the talks.
So my name is Steve Witkoff. Hello, everybody.
President Trump's Mideast peace envoy stood next to his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. They tried to put a positive spin on proceedings, but the new talk of the U.S. taking Greenland somehow cast a pall on the process. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Many single-family homes have shrubs and plants out front, right under the windows, but things may start to look different in California. The state is drafting rules to limit landscaping in the aftermath of last year's wildfires, which destroyed thousands of homes. There has been strong public pushback, though, even in the LA communities that experienced so much loss. NPR's Lauren Summer has more.
When the Eaton Fire broke out in Pasadena, Rich Snyder was home writing a presentation about wildfire risk. He has more than 30 years of experience in firefighting. So when he saw the smoke that evening, he knew it didn't look good.
My experience for all those years, I know where the smoke is going to be where the fire is going. And I saw this smoke heading off into Pasadena.
He told his wife to evacuate and started telling neighbors to go too. Snyder made what he says is a risky decision to stay. The fire was still more than a mile away, but he knew the biggest danger was from the embers that were blowing in.
They're little tiny bright red hot fireballs that are hitting you. You know, I had scorch marks on my clothes and they're going in all directions. You know, we had gusts up to 100 miles an hour with wind.
Embers can get caught in gutters, in plants, in bark mulch, where they can start new fires.
I'm looking over and I'm seeing my St. Augustine grass burning. Who would have thought green St. Augustine grass would start burning? There's hundreds of little tiny fires burning in the yards and next to the houses of all my neighbors.
The houses across the street burned down. Snyder's survived with some damage.
It was a shock, but it wasn't a surprise.
That's because what Snyder saw is something fire experts have been talking about for years. Embers spread wildfires, so it matters if something flammable is next to your house.
It's combustibles, such as vegetation, anything that will burn, and you've got direct flames that will set the house on fire.
It's why California regulators are drafting the toughest statewide rules in the country for vegetation. They're considering banning plants within 5 feet of homes in areas at risk of wildfires. Trees would still be allowed as long as the limbs are 5 feet above the roof. It's known as Zone Zero, and it would apply to about 17% of California's buildings.
We're not going to stop the fires, but we can absolutely keep them from burning our homes down. But it's a change.
A change that not everyone is welcoming.
This is not just wasteful, it's negligent.
In September, California's Board of Forestry and Fire Protection held a public hearing in Pasadena, where Pacific Palisades resident Jessica Rogers spoke.
Our community just endured the most destructive residential fire disaster in modern history. Yet this board is pushing Zone Zero policies that completely miss the mark.
Residents said they're worried about losing their greenery and shade. Some fire survivors said plants don't spread fire. They protect against it, like Martin Hawk.
I saw the well-hydrated hedges that I had planted protecting my house, acting as a fire catcher, essentially, because they were upwind.
Even in extreme fires, like in L.A., not everything burns. Some plants are left. But fire experts say that doesn't mean plants will save houses.
We don't really know how often plants can be, quote, protective and provide a buffer for homes.
Max Moritz is a wildfire specialist with the University of California Cooperative Extension. He's one of the few experts who say some green, well-watered plants may not be much of a risk because they're harder to ignite.
The really important aspect of the plants is the dead material. If most homeowners are just going to let dead material accumulate in Zone Zero anyway, then it makes sense that there shouldn't be any plants in Zone Zero.
And there are conditions where even green plants burn.
This is our burn room.
In a lab at UC Berkeley, Professor Michael Gollner and his team are getting ready to set a shrub on fire. It's inside an enclosure with sensors that measure heat.
We're good to go.
They light a small bit of mulch below the plant.
You can hear the crackling now of the plant. And you can see, once the flames actually touch the leaves, they immediately dry out and burn.
This plant is well-watered, no dead material, so it's a small fire. But Goldner says in a real wildfire, dry winds and heat from nearby flames can make things a lot worse.
Having a well-watered plant is less of a risk, but it's not no risk. That's why we think of the Zone Zero as just move a little bit away from the house, so that even these small flames from something well-watered can't get to it.
Gollner says this is a big change. People are used to having plants right next to their houses. But because fire spreads from house to house, everyone is vulnerable to what their neighbors do.
We know that whatever we do, it's got to be across the community. If you just do it in an isolated spot, it does not nearly have as strong of an effect.
California regulators were supposed to finalize the new wildfire vegetation rules by the end of December. With all the debate, they'll be considering them at least through March. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 529. You're listening to People Powered, KAXE, and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. We receive support from Paperstorm, providing on-site paper shredding services to commercial and residential customers throughout central and northern Minnesota, accepting old paperwork during tax season with secure shredding services. More information at paperstorm.net. Patchy fog overnight, lows in the mid-teens.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report.
And I feel like over here's the living room. Over there's the kitchen.
Temperatures plummeted and winds whipped the landscape into a white wasteland Thursday, but warmth emanated from the Jarvie Britt home in Cohasset. The house was largely empty, a bed frame in one room, a lamp and a rug in another, but the colorful Christmas tree in the corner and the gifts underneath reflected the wonder that filled the space. Misty Jarvie, Reese Britt, and their daughters Adeline and Clarity were one of four families chosen for a home by Itasca County Habitat for Humanity this year. It was the little things that they marveled over at their home dedication just a week before Christmas. The light and shower door in the bathroom. The gem shape of the hardware.
Oh my gosh! Ooh. That's a bunch of cake.
Check out your cake.
That is a bunch of cake.
Two cakes, stashed in the fridge to share with everyone who gathered to celebrate. Nearly 30 people came, despite the bad weather.
Typically, we do just one cake, but and don't usually have people like having to line the back hallway in order to be able to fit in to see, you know, to hear the comments and so forth.
Habitat Family Support Manager Amanda McDonald says it's a testament to how special Misty and Reese are.
You don't meet people every day that you think about even after hours, after you're done with work. They're like a family that are my family now that I want to stay connected with for years to come.
A special family gets a special house. Their home is Itasca County Habitat's first net zero build. McDonald says there's a perception in the community that people are, quote, working the system. She says that's not Misty and Reese.
They are ones that are working as hard as they can to improve their future and for themselves as well as their kids.
Standing in front of the Christmas tree with her family, facing the crowded room, Misty's mouth was open in disbelief. Soon it was pinched with emotion.
I had no idea we'd have this much support in our community or even this much hands to even help us. We really thought it honestly was going to be no one besides us.
As part of the Habitat process, families put in sweat equity, helping to build their home and the homes of other Habitat families. But volunteers are needed to make the workload lighter. Connie Daigle says groups that came to help Misty and Reese expanded their family.
You have your Walmart family, you have your neighbors, you have your church families, you have your Habitat family, you have your school family, the Cohasset teachers came and helped. You're loved by a lot of people. Mm-hmm.
Daigle is a longtime member of Habitat's Family Selection Committee. She's also a substitute teacher. She's subbed for Adeline's class each of the last 5 years.
The bigger surprise came last January when we came to your home to do a visit. And you said, girls, there are people here to visit with us. Come on out. And you go, Adeline, this is Daigle. And I go, I didn't know you were here. Just, I didn't know you were coming either. And that was not why you got the house. There were many other reasons, but she didn't hurt.
Adeline, Clarity, do you want to say anything?
Thank you.
Oh, that's good.
Executive Director Jamie Majelsness says the family's journey started almost a year ago when Misty wrote a prayer.
She wrote that prayer not for anything extravagant, but for the simple, vital need of a safe, healthy home where her family could find stability and a sense of belonging. In January 2025, this family was chosen for this project. We saw the beginning of the answer to that prayer. It has been clear to all of us that God had a hand in this from the very start.
Before Daigle presented the family with the keys to their house, the family's pastor led everyone in a group blessing.
So as a symbol of cooperative goodwill, work, and sharing,
we dedicate this house.
That this home may be a place of love and respect,
we dedicate this house.
As a place where this family may grow, play, and learn,
we dedicate this house.
That this house may serve as a place for rest, shelter, and laughter.
That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Fresh off the military operation to seize the president of Venezuela, President Trump took a victory lap in front of House Republicans today. He spoke with the goal of laying out a winning midterm agenda, which raises the question, how will this international intervention be received among the America First wing of his movement? And do Republicans see it as an accomplishment they can tout? NPR's Mara Liasson joins us now from the White House. Hi there.
Hi there.
So, Mara, tell us, what did we learn from the president's appearance today?
Well, he was told to give a midterm speech, and he did do that after a while. He went to the House Republican retreat, and during what was meant to be a pep rally, he spoke for 80 minutes, a lot of minutes. Mm-hmm. But after many, many minutes, he detailed what he said was the roadmap to success for Republicans, giving Americans money directly to buy health insurance, lowering prescription drug prices and gas prices, and continuing to ban transgender athletes from competition. Here's what he said.
And I think I gave you something. It's just a roadmap, and it's a roadmap to victory. You have so many good nuggets. You have to use them. If you can sell them, we're going to win.
But the biggest news is what he didn't say. He did talk about the Venezuelan raid, but he said nothing at all about what happens next. And that, I think, is a clear indication that he doesn't want Republicans to run on Venezuela, and he hopes that the midterms are not about Venezuela.
Right. And those who know the anti-interventionist views of some parts of Trump's base might have wondered how his core supporters would view this Venezuelan intervention. What can you tell us so far?
What we know is that in the flush of victory, there are very few Republicans that are critical, even though this was a huge departure from Trump's previous promises to stay out of foreign entanglements and wars. Now, what the raid and its aftermath might tell us is, what is MAGA? Is it whatever Trump wants on a given day? Or does it have core principles like non-interventionism that would transcend Trump? And Trump was asked this very question on NBC News yesterday about what will MAGA think about this? And he said, quote, MAGA loves it. MAGA loves what I'm doing. MAGA loves everything I do. MAGA is me. MAGA loves everything I do, and I love everything I do, too. Now, even by Trump standards, that's a stunning statement. He does have a firmer hold on his party's base than any modern president. Now, so far, he hasn't lost support among his base, but then again, his base is only 30% of the electorate.
And Mara, as you mentioned earlier, there are so few Republican voices that are freely critical of Trump and the Republican Party today, but what do we know about people who might not identify with Trump's MAGA movement, but who were open to voting for Trump? Do we know how swing voters are responding?
Well, that is the next big political question. We don't have polling yet on that. We do know that before the arrest of Maduro, 70% of Americans told CBS pollsters that they were against military intervention in Venezuela. So they're not so sure. They'd rather have him focusing on the cost of health care and groceries and not spending taxpayer dollars, quote, running Venezuela, whatever that means. So Trump clearly communicated today by leaving out Venezuela while rallying Republicans that while he is proud to brag about the raid, he doesn't really want to talk about what comes next.
Even if the modern Republican Party is, well, whatever Trump says it is, there is still this question about the future of MAGA because President Trump, as we know, is barred from running again for president in 2028.
Yes, and I think the future of the Republican Party will be resolved in a competition between Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Vice President J.D. Vance. Both of them are presidential hopefuls. Rubio now has the main role in Venezuela. He's being called the Viceroy of Venezuela. He's also the National Security Advisor and the Secretary of State. Meanwhile, Vance has been conspicuously absent. He wasn't at the big press conference yesterday, but he has represented the non-interventionist wing of MAGA up until now. So we'll see how Venezuela plays out, and that will affect the futures of these two ambitious men.
NPR's Mara Liasson, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump has made no secret that he wants U.S. oil companies to profit off his removal of Venezuelan President Maduro, but there are lots of reasons why companies might be hesitant to rush in. NPR's Camila Domonoske takes a look at the obstacles and the incentives.
Let's start with this. Right now, the world is making more oil than it needs. By some calculations, about 2 million barrels per day more than it needs.
And if that sounds like a lot, it is.
Kevin Book is the managing director at Clearview Energy Partners, an independent research firm. And because the world has more oil supply than demand, crude prices are quite low. The global benchmark is a little over $60 right now. That's just not high enough to motivate companies to race to invest the billions of dollars that would be needed to dramatically increase production in Venezuela. In fact, for a few years now, oil companies have generally been kind of tight-fisted about their investments. Selective. Not like they used to be more than a decade ago during the fracking revolution, Kevin Book says.
The go-go days of shale tended to be a drill first and figure out the math later time in the oil industry's history, and it didn't go that well for many of the companies that produced first and asked questions later.
At that time, U.S. oil companies drilled a lot of wells, the price of oil crashed, and they lost a lot of money. So right now, companies are asking questions first. Questions like, will we actually make money on this? Okay, so the world has plenty of oil right now. Prices are low and companies are being cautious. On top of that, the crude that comes out of Venezuela is kind of gnarly. Claudio Galimberti is an economist with the research company Rystad Energy.
It is one of the heaviest and one of the dirtiest crude that you can find.
Heavy crude is thick, sticky, viscous. It's more difficult to transport and to refine, and producing it is even worse for the climate than other types of oil. And on the surface, that might seem like yet another reason not to go after this oil. But here's the plot twist. The refineries along the U.S. Gulf Coast are perfectly set up for working with this tricky crude.
Why? Because of the proximity to the crude from Venezuela.
And to Mexico and the Gulf and Canada, all places with lots of heavy crude. Because they were close to that crude, refineries made big investments decades ago in the kind of equipment needed to refine that viscous stuff. But then that shale revolution happened, bringing a boom in light, sweet crude that doesn't need that equipment. And Venezuelan production collapsed, and now some of that expensive equipment that's perfectly poised to handle heavy crude, it's kind of going to waste. So Galimberti says if the situation in Venezuela truly stabilizes and oil companies do move in and boost production, it'd be great news for those refineries.
Once these barrels come back, they fully utilize this equipment and therefore they make more money.
And then, of course, there's the long game. Yes, there's an oil glut today, and depending on what happens with electric vehicles and China's energy transition, maybe oil demand goes down. But then again, maybe in a few years, the world is hungry for oil again. And when companies are thinking about where to grow, there aren't many places with as much undeveloped oil as Venezuela. ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips haven't operated in Venezuela since the government forcibly renegotiated contracts around 2007, which cost them billions. Chevron is the only U.S. oil company still operating in Venezuela. Multiple oil companies declined to comment for this story. They haven't publicly signaled what they're planning. For now, the biggest question is whether the situation in Venezuela will stabilize enough that companies are willing to make investments at all. And even then, Galimberti says they'll probably need encouragement, subsidies, to do it at today's low prices. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. Governor Tim Walz was highly critical of President Donald Trump and Minnesota Republicans during a news conference Tuesday. He took questions about his decision to exit the 2026 race for a third term in office. Walz told reporters his decision was the right one and one he made with his family, as a war is being waged on Minnesota by the federal government. The state is facing increasing pressure from multiple fronts, including Tuesday's announcement of 2,000 federal agents apparently being sent to the state for immigration enforcement and fraud investigations. Walz is being heavily scrutinized for his handling of fraud in the state's health and human services programs. But he says the focus on the state is endangering livelihoods and even lives. Here's Walz from Care 11's live broadcast.
This is a concerted effort to try and destroy the president's opponents, to destroy the rule of law, and it became apparent to me that he was going to do that with me being there.
Walz was especially heated when it came to Trump amplifying a conspiracy theory that the governor was somehow involved in the assassination of former House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark last June. He called on the state's Republicans to condemn the president's social media post.
For those legislators who went and shed crocodile tears at her funeral, shame on you. Shame on you. Her children are asking you to do one thing in her name. It's to tell the president to stop doing this.
Walz also says he will not resign, as some have called him to do, and that Republicans will not win the governor's race.
Buck stops with me. I'm accountable for this. And because of that accountability, I'm not running for office again. But I have a year to continue to improve on a record that I think will stand up against anybody's.
The intention of the news conference was to celebrate the launch of the state's paid leave program on January 1st. The governor says the program is launching on time, under budget, and with strong safeguards in place to prevent fraud. Nearly 18,000 Minnesotans have applied for the program, and to date, about 3,500 have been approved. Babbitt Mayor Andrea Zupancic will again run for State Senate District 3, setting up a likely rematch with DFL Senator Grant Hochschild. Megan Buffington has more.
The Republican lost by just 703 votes in 2022. Zupancic says she would use her experience as a mother, wife, mayor, and small business owner in office. She owns the real estate company Zup North, and her husband is a fourth-generation owner of Zup's Grocery. Zupancic called out Hochschild in her announcement, saying he is a, quote, rubber stamp for the far-left metro agenda. She says she is running to restore balance in state government and advance common-sense solutions to make life more affordable. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
How healthy is the Northland? The Bridge to Health survey is trying to answer that question, but it needs your responses to do so. Surveys have been sent to households in northeastern Minnesota every 5 years since 1995. The goal is to fill gaps in local data by asking questions about topics like substance use, access to care, and mental health. Surveys are randomly mailed out to households in the service area, but to get good data, enough people have to fill them out. The first mailing was in September, but the Bridges to Health survey sent out another round to Itasca, Kennebec, Kuching, Pine, and St. Louis counties in December. The anonymous survey data is available online and is used by schools, health systems, and nonprofits. The data helped Essentia Health and Mesabi East with a $10,000 U.S. Department of Agriculture grant for a farm-to-school program. Other projects spurred by the data include a farmers market in Duluth and suicide prevention efforts in Aiken County. The research effort is led by the University of Wisconsin-Superior with support from over 40 local organizations. Heads up, teachers. Expect lots of Olivers, Adelines, Sophias, and Hudsons in your upcoming classes. Those four baby names were the most popular in northern Minnesota in 2025, according to data from 8 area hospitals. But while dozens of like-minded parents christened their babies the same, there were still plenty of unique names like Leonard, Opaline, or River. Other top names include Jackson, Henry, and Charlotte. Check out our full list at KAXE.org. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
It's 5:48. You're listening to All Things Considered here on People Powered, KAXE, KBXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And 7 o'clock, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Then at 10 o'clock tonight, Malachi Coons, your host for Headwaters. It's more great music. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. And support comes from Thrive Up North, sharing the stories of a welcoming community of people who've chosen to make Itasca County their new home, promoting all the area has to offer, including natural amenities and jobs in healthcare, manufacturing, and more. Offering an incentive package to help with your move to the area. Learn more at thriveupnorth.com. Our weather forecast for tonight, patchy fog and mostly cloudy, lows 14 to 18, winds from the northwest 5 to 15. Becoming partly sunny tomorrow with highs near 36, winds from the west 10 to 15, and for Thursday, partly sunny, highs near 34. You can get rid of that old car, truck, or boat that is taking up room. KAXE's Cars program makes it quick and easy, and it can get towed away for free. Proceeds from your unwanted vehicle become fuel for KAXE, KBXE. Visit kaxe.org/cars to get started, or you can call Heather at 218-326-1234 for more information. It's Take a Kid Ice Fishing Weekend, January 17th through the 19th, all across Minnesota. Residents may fish or spear without a license when accompanied by a child age 15 or younger. There is a special event on Saturday, January 17th, 1 to 3 at Lake Bemidji State Park, with equipment and heated shelters provided.
They would unfreeze funding after individual states provided certain, quote, administrative data. He didn't specify exactly what data, and as of yesterday, a childcare advocate told me it was still unclear to many states what they need to do to unfreeze these funds. Then on Monday, the department also announced changes to some of the rules around how states distribute those funds. For example, encouraging states to use verified attendance rather than enrollment when figuring out how much childcare providers should get. In a press release, HHS Deputy Secretary Jim O'Neill said, quote, "The reforms we're enacting will make fraud harder to perpetrate." And finally, the New York Times reported today that the Trump administration plans to freeze nearly $2.4 billion in Child Care Development Fund payments to five Democratic states. HHS confirmed that report to NPR, but didn't respond to questions about how this funding freeze differs from the one announced last week.
And what have you been hearing about what this all could mean for child care centers?
Yeah, so I talked to child care advocates who are pretty confused right now. They told me that the rules currently in place have really helped make the child care industry more stable and affordable. And they're worried about the consequences of changing policies that were working and also interrupting the funding stream, even in the short term. This is Susan Gail Perry of Child Care Aware of America, which helps families access affordable child care.
It's critical that the nearly 1 million families who are relying on child care subsidy assistance have continuity of services so that they can go to work and support their families.
She told me child care can be extremely expensive, and most providers are operating on razor-thin margins. She said a funding freeze that results in even a month without federal support could lead to some child care centers closing.
And Wright, if you can, remind us of some of the backstory here. How did these Minnesota allegations lead to large-scale federal changes?
Yeah, this all started with a viral YouTube video posted by conservative content creator Nick Shirley. In it, he visited seemingly empty daycare centers where he accused Somali-American daycare operators of not providing services to any children despite receiving federal funds. The video doesn't offer clear proof, but it went viral. And while the Justice Department has charged dozens of people in connection with a COVID-era fraud scheme in Minnesota, Shirley's allegations have not been verified.
That was Cade Mills of NPR's Education Desk. Thank you.
Thank you.
Workers at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland are still struggling after workforce cuts last year. Now they're also grieving the loss of a beloved library that closed this week. NPR's Kadia Riddle is covering this. Hey there, Kadia.
Hi, Mary Louise.
So I want to get to the library in just a second, but set the stage first, because I know you've spent a lot of time these last few months reporting on all kinds of things happening at Goddard.
That's right. Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland is a flagship campus for NASA. It's been a hub of innovation and scholarship for the agency for decades. Think of projects like the James Webb Space Telescope or Hubble Space Telescope. Like other federal agencies under the Trump administration, NASA saw reductions in staff. By some estimates, Goddard lost about a third of what their staff once was. Now it's down to about 6,600 people. Since those reductions, management has been working to close buildings and laboratories on campus. That includes the campus library. NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman calls this part of a long-planned, quote, transformation.
A transformation. Do staff like this transformation? What do they say about it?
Well, for this story, I talked to five people who work at Goddard or recently left. Two of them agreed to be named by NPR. Three spoke to me on the condition of anonymity because they're fearful of losing their jobs. That's in addition to previous reporting on this subject. Staff I've talked to stress that it's not a transformation because they've been given no reassurances that important spaces like the library will be replaced or rehabilitated. They also describe the effort as chaotic and unorganized. One person used the word cruel. People recount things like specialized laboratories being dismantled with little notice and laboratory equipment hastily moved. Staff say these efforts have thrown sand in the gears of their work and really damaged morale, which was already low after losing so many colleagues in the reduction. And the library especially is a beloved place.
Okay, tell me why.
Well, staffs talk about spending time there collaborating with colleagues, doing research, or accessing documents really unique to NASA. I spoke with Dave Williams. He's a planetary scientist who retired recently after working there for more than 30 years. And he says he spent thousands of hours in the library.
And we have a database covering all the missions and everything that's flown back all the way back to Sputnik, actually.
Williams said that historical records of NASA's previous missions are immensely helpful in informing current work. And since they're not necessarily digitized, they're not available anywhere else.
If you don't go back and look at these old missions, you can end up making the same mistakes that you made in missions in the first place.
Okay, you're helping us understand the value of this library. Why then is it being dismantled?
Well, some in Congress say it's part of a broader effort from the Trump administration to shrink NASA. I talked to Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland. He stressed that it's up to him and his colleagues to restore bipartisan support for Goddard, especially looking towards the 2026 budget.
I think that will send a very clear signal that we intend for Goddard to continue its pioneering missions.
But meanwhile, what happens to the library? What happens to all this specialized data that it was holding?
Well, it's unclear what will happen to it. I did reach out to NASA and Goddard officials. They declined an interview request. They directed me to a statement from NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman. He downplayed concerns and said that people at Goddard will continue to have access to digital content and books via the federal interlibrary loan process, as well as help from librarians. He says nothing will be thrown out without formal consideration. But people like planetary scientist Dave Williams say they're not reassured and they're fearful of what kind of invaluable data and resources could be lost and never recovered.
That is science correspondent Kadia Riddle. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the University of Maryland Libraries, home to the NPR Archives, dedicated to preserving the history of public broadcasting and serving researchers around the world. More at lib.umd.edu. And from Progressive Insurance, now hiring for virtual and hybrid employment, offering opportunities for professional development and career progression. Position details can be found at careers.progressive.com.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota, operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. Patchy fog tonight, mostly cloudy, lows 14 to 18.